Hello and welcome to Redefine, your home for news about parental school choice and education reform.
All right, Matt, thank you so much for taking some time out for me today. Well, let me start off with the obvious question. For those who may not know, what is an education savings account?
Well, in the school choice context, an education savings account is a new type of school choice program that basically has the state put money into an account managed by the parent for use in educating the child. So it's sort of a evolutionary step from something like, for instance, a school voucher, which is when the state gives a coupon to a parent that allows them to go to a public or private school of their choice. Education savings account program, there is an amount of money that is in an account that has limited but multiple uses, and parents can choose, for instance, do they want to send their child to a public or private school, or would they prefer to kind of do half-time at school and to do some online programs? Would they prefer to send their child to a community college? We only have one program like this in existence right now in Arizona, and one of the allowable uses is to actually save money in a federal 529 account for future university expenses. So we like to say that ESAs are sort of, school choice and parental control over education down to the last penny.
Okay. Well, you recently put together a report for the Friedman Foundation about ESAs. For those who haven't read the report yet, can you kind of give us the Reader's Digest version of why ESAs are a better way to go than, say, vouchers or tax credit scholarships?
Yeah, the reasoning here gets a little technical, but the broad answer is, there are technical reasons, but the broader answer is that what we really want to do is allow parents to customize the education for their child. It should not be, education shouldn't be necessarily an all or nothing proposition. You're either attending this school or that school. In fact, the whole definition of what a school is being fairly rapidly changed by technology. So, the advantage, one of the huge advantages of an ESA program is that it allows, or actually requires parents to judge the effectiveness of different education options based not only on the perceived quality of the options, but also on price. And this could get kind of narrow and wonky, but the bottom line is that parents in an ESA program, where one of the uses is to save for future university expenses, you wind up choosing things based on not just do I think they're good or not, but do I think they're good if they deliver a good value for the dollar. And we argue in the Friedman Foundation paper that this creates a better institutional setup to encourage people to develop new, better, more effective schooling models, and that also requires a consideration of cost. So basically, it's a sort of the closer we can get to the actual market here, in the sense that parents could be in control of these things, making decisions, judging, basing their decisions on both quality and cost, the better the outcomes, I should say, we'll see for children.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about the cost piece, and, I know this might, like you said, be a little narrow and wonky, but that is a huge part of why you see this as a good thing. Can you talk about why considering cost and all this is important? I mean, not only for the family, obviously, but for taxpayers.
Sure. One of the examples we give in the paper is of the Milwaukee Voucher Program. And the Milwaukee Voucher Program gives vouchers to families that are worth a maximum of about $6,400. And the way it structures the actual payment amount in the voucher is to say that you either get a maximum of $6,400 or the cost of educating the child, whichever of those two figures is less. Okay? And lo and behold, we look today, and every single private school participating in the Milwaukee Voucher Program is collecting $6,400 per pupil, right? You would be make the argument in the paper that this is, you know, the Milwaukee program has been a great success. It's a wonderful program. It delivers better academic results for about half the cost of the Milwaukee district, right? It's higher graduation rates, higher parental satisfaction, higher test scores, all these things. But what it's not designed to do is to get someone to come into the market with a high-quality new high-quality school model that can operate on, say, $5,500 per year. That's right. Mm-hmm. That sort of innovation is not something that we're going to see necessarily from sort of a traditional voucher model. So the advantage in investing the money directly under the control, actual control of the parents, is that, you know, you really kind of set the stage for people to try new things, to develop new schooling models, and to do it at a lower cost. And we think this is a key feature of the ESA programs, because it's, you know, sort of nudging us in the opposite direction that American schooling has been going for the last 40 years, which is to see costs ever rising without any kind of, significant increase in performance.
Gotcha. Right?
And that didn't happen on accident, right? That's the way the incentives of our system works right now. So if you want to reverse that, then you have to do something, you know, that's going to seem a little radical at first, but, by giving parents complete control of the money and requiring them to consider possible alternative uses for that money, really creates them, sets them up to be, discriminating consumers of educational providers. Now, my personal feeling about this, however, is that even if someone were to go whole hog with this concept, what you would wind up seeing is you'd still see the vast majority of children going to public schools.
Well, Matt, as you know better than me, we have, you know, a whole bunch of states lining up this year to try either vouchers or tax credit scholarships. In your view, would it be better for those states to bypass those programs and go straight to ESAs?
Not necessarily, no. As I mentioned, we only have one program like this operating. It's here in Arizona. And there are, you know, I think there's some value in being cautious rather than, for instance, it would be, you know, kind of fun for you know, school choice people like me to go around and perhaps ridicule the voucher programs as, you know, rotary phone technology or something. But the bottom line is that we're not really ready to do that yet. There are a number of issues in administering a program like this, which I believe will be resolved, but are still kind of in the process of being resolved, even here in Arizona. So there are, you know, I think that the stage we're at now is that we need some people to undertake sort of pilot programs of this concept, to work the kinks out, to make sure that they work. And, you know, it's, you know, I think rather than sort of rushing into something with little information. Those that go and pass voucher and tax credit programs could potentially, you know, sort of evolve those programs into an ESA approach at some point. Mm-hmm. When we, you know everything that we need to know. I would imagine that we're a couple of years away from being able to, you know, to be to the point where it'd be wise of us to say, no, don't do that, don't do this, do this thing over here. Of course, this is going to ultimately be a decision that is made on the ground by, you know, lawmakers and advocates in each state.
How fertile a landscape do you think Florida is for trying something like this? I mean, you know, obviously we have vouchers and tax credit scholarships. Do you think we're a good place for taking the next step?
It could be. I think, interesting things to me, and one of the arguments I developed in the Friedman paper, is that the Florida experience with school choice to date clearly, you know, demonstrates that this, you know, a lot of the myths that school choice opponents put up there are just that. They're myths. They're not even very sophisticated ones. For instance, the McKay Scholarship Program has been available to every child with a disability in Florida since 2002. And lo and behold, here now, we're going on 11 years later, there are 5% of children with disabilities in Florida actually using the program directly.
No wholesale exodus.
No wholesale exodus. But at the same time, we see that Florida has some of the biggest gains in the public school special ed kids in the country when you look at national test scores on the NAEP. So Florida's scores, you know, academic scores for children with disabilities in public school have gone way up. There's more children with disabilities attending Florida's public schools today than there was back when they passed the program in 2002. And only 5% of the students are using the program directly. But it's my argument that all students with disabilities in Florida have benefited from the McKay Scholarship Program because it's there if they need it, right? This is the old, you know, Sun Tzu saying about the best swords are the ones that stay in their sheath.
If I understand it right, you see ESAs being available to all. But you also talk about a sliding scale, right, where the amount would vary depending on income, need, circumstances.
Yeah.
Why is that the way to go?
I think that we've had this long-standing debate in the school choice movement about whether school choice programs should be means-tested and thus only available to people below a certain income, or should they be universal? Should everyone be able to benefit from them? And in a lot of ways, this is a debate that stretches, you know, back before the first voucher program even passed. Milton Friedman was an advocate of universal school vouchers, whereas a lot of the progressive supporters of school choice that sort of came up, during the 1960s and 70s, were very much interested in school choice as a means of promoting societal equity, and thus wanted to keep them restricted to low-income children.
Mm-hmm.
My personal take on this question is equity is an extremely important issue, but I think there are better ways to deal with it than means testing. I think that when you look at the public school system of today, children of all income levels are eligible to attend it, right? I mean, Bill Gates can go and put his child in a public school tomorrow if he wants to. They may be attending public school now, for all I know. And it would seem very strange to everyone to say that, oh, no, Bill Gates may have to pay, you know, taxes to the school system, but he's not allowed to enroll his children in them, right? It would also be strange for people to say, well, we should have charter schools, but we should only allow low-income children to enroll in them, right? That seems odd to us because everyone pays the taxes, right, that supports the charter schools and the district schools. And likewise, whether it is in the form of vouchers or in the form of tax credits are essentially foregone public funds, if not public funds themselves. It seems kind of odd and insupportable to me to say that, well, everyone basically contributes to these things, but only children below X income level can participate in them. To me, the better way to deal with these equity issues is to make everyone eligible for them, but to vary the amount of aid. So, for instance, we can give lower-income children larger scholarships. We can give children with disabilities larger scholarships. This is essentially what the public school system does now, to some extent. But, you know, the idea that we should restrict them, the children of, you know, middle and higher income taxpayers, from participating in these programs seems unwise to me.
Well, here's my last question about ESAs, and it kind of ties into everything you've already talked about. You know, as I was reading the Friedman report, the term vouchers 2.0 kept coming to my mind. But I wondered whether the world was ready for them. You know, I wonder if at this time when people are still getting their heads around vouchers and tax credit scholarships, if they could also embrace ESA. So, you know, what's your take? I mean, realistically, politically, is the time ripe for ESAs, or is this something for a little further down the road?
I think that, you know, the world wasn't ready for Palm Pilots when they came out. But, they wasn't. And, you know, and they didn't take off for a long, long time, or the concept didn't take off for a long time. So is the world ready for education savings account right now? No, probably not right now. Like I said, there are issues to figure out and whatnot and, that are being figured out. But I mean, in the end, I think that as a movement, we always need to be taking a strong interest in the development of our product, and our product in this case is our methods to increasing the freedom and effectiveness of the school, the parents within the schooling system. So I think there's work to be done, but I do think that when this work is done, we will have a product that is clearly superior to those that we have today, which is not to denigrate those products at all.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you very much for taking all this time to give us a lesson on ESAs.
Great. Talk to you soon.